Hey there, and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. It has been quite a week. My family took its first holiday since the crisis started. We drove all the way to Long Beach, about half an hour away, and rented an extremely well-ventilated Airbnb and worked from there instead of from home. So our daughter homeschooled and we did our work in the morning, and then we managed to steal a couple hours every afternoon to go to the beach or to check out the neighborhoods. Unfortunately, we did not get to Catalina Island because we mistimed the ferry, but we're going to do that next time, we think. So it was actually quite nice to get a change of scenery. We went out on a whale watching boat in the harbor, and we saw some toothy dolphins, which I think are technically whales, at least according to our guide, who, it must be noted, also had a money-back guarantee in the event that we didn't see whales. So take that for what it's worth. I hope that you and your family are taking some time to take care of yourselves, whether that's just going for a walk or finding a way to get out of town for a day or just get to a different part of town. It has been a very intense 5-6 months for all of us, and I think we're all starting to feel it, judging from current affairs out there. Well, I do have some events coming up on my calendar. On September the 22nd, I'm doing the keynote for the Law Via the Internet conference. And on October the 1st, I'm appearing at the Afterworlds Literary Festival in Nova Scotia for a panel called Writing into an Uncertain Future. But between now and those events, there will be a lot of public events that are just not finalized yet, and podcasts and live streams and whatnot, because the publicity for Attack Surface, the third Little Brother book, is really starting to hit its stride. And I have booked interviews of one kind or another, I think every day this week, next week, and the week after, some days two or three, and there's going to be even more. Now, not all of that is off the back of Attack Surface. Some of it is actually to do with the podcast reading I'm going to do today, because I'm not going to continue reading Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town this week, although all other things being equal, I'll pick that up for next week. This week, I'm going to read to you a little from a new book I published this week, a short book called How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. Now, it's a funny story how I came to write this book. I had been reading Shoshana Zuboff's book on surveillance capitalism. I'd also read her scholarly work that preceded it. And although I was very sympathetic to her goal of controlling the power of surveillance capitalism and of large tech firms, and also share her horror of surveillance, I found that I had really deep disagreements, not like mere sectarian ones, but profound ones about what was going on with surveillance capitalism and what to do with it. And that, moreover, I felt like her remedies were unlikely to work, that we could do all the things she asked us to do and still end up with all of the problems that I cared about getting worse. And so I started to write a review of her book, and that review ended up running to nearly 30,000 words. And that is too long to publish as a book review. And I had the idea that it was actually, with a little work, could be turned into a standalone book, a pamphlet in the model of the ones that Columbia University Press has been doing. Tim Wu did one on Brandeis and competition called The Curse of Bigness. There's also one from Columbia Global Reports, the Speech Police book by David Kay, who was the UN Special Rapporteur on Free Speech. And that length, that kind of 20 to 35,000 word length, is, I think, a really good one for a kind of long polemical essay. Long enough that you can get into some substantive arguments, but not one of these sort of 700-page tomes that if you want to be part of the discourse, you have to set aside weeks to really digest. It's rare that a book that long merits that much material. Even books that I'm quite fond of, like Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, really didn't need to be as long as they were. I think Piketty, if you've read that book, and you probably haven't, to be honest, most people have not read Piketty. If you read that book, what you'll find is that Piketty's core thesis fits in the first 100 or so pages, but that he's saying something that at the time was considered very heterodox. It was the kind of thing that was likely to attract a lot of outraged denunciations from other people in his field. And so he devoted the rest of the book to restating his thesis in light of possible objections. Like, maybe you think that this could explain this phenomenon I'm describing. Well, no, let me tell you why that can't be it either. And he goes through them all. He does a really good job. But if you read Piketty, and you should, and you get to a point where you're like, didn't I already read this? You can put the book down. You've actually got the whole thing. The only thing that you're gaining from continuing to read it is some of the anticipated counterarguments. You've absorbed the whole thesis after 100 pages. So I wanted to write something about that length too. And I wrote it, and it went to my traditional publisher, to Tor Books, who are branching out into nonfiction, but it wasn't quite what they're looking for. I don't know if they've done any nonfiction yet, but this wasn't what they were after, which is fine. And then it sat with another publisher, a very good tech publisher, for about 7 months and was delayed during their restructuring and then basically got spiked after the pandemic hit. But then 1-0 picked it up, and 1-0 is part of Medium. And the editor there that I'm working with is Brian Marchant, who is a very veteran tech editor, but also a science fiction writer. So someone who's very simpatico with my work. And he did an amazing job shepherding it through 1-0. They've never done a book like this before. And not only that, but they arranged to do a print-on-demand edition that should be coming shortly, as well as traditional ebook editions. As it stands, you can read it online on 10.medium.com, and of course there'll be a link to that in the show notes. And one of the ways in which this is an extraordinary publication is that 10 really put a lot of energy into making it into a really good digital publication. So on the one hand, it's very beautiful. They got an illustrator named Sheena Inbar, who specializes in animated illustrations, to do a suite of illos for it, each more beautiful than the last. I'm so happy with how that worked out. But also they invented a bunch of new navigational material, stuff that they'd had in their labs, but that they hadn't yet deployed for production. That makes it easier for you to navigate this very long document. They call it a 109-minute read. I'm not going to read you the whole book this morning, obviously, but this long book that allows you to not just keep your pace, but, you know, kind of navigate through it and go back and reference older sections and so on. It's a very clever way of presenting web-based long reads, better than anything I've seen so far. So it was very exciting to see that treatment for the book. And being an online publication, it wasn't exactly clear when it was going to see the light of day. And so I knew that there was a good chance it would come out last week, but I didn't have an exact day of publication until late one afternoon while I was out on the whale watching cruise. I got some email from my editor saying, can you just have a once over, because we're going to push it out at 1 a.m. tonight. And so that was how I spent much of my holiday, doing the extremely pleasant work of talking to the press and talking to readers and letting readers know about it and so on. And it's attracted a lot of critical attention from people who are engaging with it substantively. And it really means a lot to me, because the underlying material in this book, in this short book, is really a good tour of a substantial part of my thinking about tech and policy and economics. Not the whole story, but a really big slice of it. And I feel like I managed to do something very synthetic. I managed to pull together a lot of the different things that I think about and unify them into a larger piece that is more than any of its parts are, because of the way that those parts are juxtaposed. And this is really how I try to work. It's a very bloggerish way to work, where you have these short articles where you try to make sense of things atomically. And then, you know, they float around in your subconscious as kind of fragments of a larger whole. And this supersaturated solution occasionally has a couple of these fragments bang together and nucleate and crystallize into a really significant new piece. And that's really where this came from. It's also where, you know, my novels and other longer form work come from too. But it's been a while since I had something like this in the nonfiction realm. Anyway, that's what I got to say about this book by way of formatter. Now I'm going to do a short reading. It is Sunday as I read this to you, and I'm doing some more press for this book. I'm going to do a 3-hour live cast with Leo Laporte this afternoon and this week in tech. So I'm going to try and claim a couple hours for myself. I've been up since pretty early, wrote a couple of book reviews today and a couple of long blog posts already. So after this, I'm going to go for a swim, put out our recycling bins, and then settle in for my 3-hour live cast. Anyway, it's been lovely telling you about this book. I hope you'll go and check it out. Again, it's called How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism. And to whet your appetite, here's the first section or so of that. How to Destroy Surveillance Capitalism by Cory Doctorow. Part 1. The Net of a Thousand Lies. The most surprising thing about the rebirth of flat earthers in the 21st century is just how widespread the evidence against them is. You can understand how centuries ago, people who'd never gained a high enough vantage point from which to see the Earth's curvature might come to the common sense belief that the flat-seeming Earth was indeed flat. But today, when elementary schools routinely dangle GoPro cameras from balloons and loft them high enough to photograph the Earth's curvature, to say nothing of the unexceptional sight of the curved Earth from an airplane window, it takes a heroic effort to maintain the belief that the world is flat. Likewise, for white nationalism and eugenics, in an age where you can become a computational genomics data point by swabbing your cheek and mailing it to a gene sequencing company along with a modest sum of money, race science has never been easier to refute. We are living through both a golden age of readily available facts and denial of those facts. Terrible ideas that have lingered on the fringes for decades or even centuries have gone mainstream, seemingly overnight. When an obscure idea gains currency, there are only two things that can explain its ascendance. Either the person expressing the idea has gotten a lot better at stating their case, or the proposition has become harder to deny in the face of mounting evidence. In other words, if we want people to take climate change seriously, we can get a bunch of Greta Thunbergs to make eloquent, passionate arguments from podiums, winning our hearts and minds, or we can wait for flood, fire, broiling sun, and pandemics to make the case for us. In practice, we'll probably have to do some of both. The more we're boiling and burning and drowning and wasting away, the easier it will be for the Greta Thunbergs of the world to convince us. The arguments for ridiculous beliefs and odious conspiracies like anti-vaccination, climate denial, a flat earth, and eugenics are no better than they were a generation ago. Indeed, they're worse because they are being pitched to people who have at least a background awareness of the refuting facts. Anti-vax has been around since the first vaccines, but the early anti-vaxxers were pitching people who were less equipped to understand even the most basic ideas from microbiology, and moreover, those people had not witnessed the extermination of mass-murdering diseases like polio, smallpox, and measles. Today's anti-vaxxers are no more eloquent than their forebears, and they have a much harder job. So, can these far-fetched conspiracy theorists really be succeeding on the basis of superior arguments? Some people think so. Today, there is a widespread belief that machine learning and commercial surveillance can turn even the most fumble-tongued conspiracy theorist into a Svengali who can warp your perceptions and win your belief by locating vulnerable people and then pitching them with AI-refined arguments that bypass their rational faculties. And turn everyday people into flat earthers or anti-vaxxers or even Nazis. When the Rand Corporation blames Facebook for radicalization, and when Facebook's role in spreading coronavirus misinformation is blamed on its algorithm, the implicit message is that machine learning and surveillance are causing the changes in our consensus about what's true. After all, in a world where sprawling and incoherent conspiracy theories like Pizzagate and its successor QAnon have widespread followings, something must be afoot. But what if there's another explanation? What if it's the material circumstances, and not the arguments, that are making the difference for these conspiracy pitchmen? What if the trauma of living through real conspiracies all around us, conspiracies among wealthy people, their lobbyists, and lawmakers to bury inconvenient facts and evidence of wrongdoing, these conspiracies are commonly known as corruption, is making people vulnerable to conspiracy theories? If it's trauma and not contagion, material conditions and not ideology, that is making the difference today and enabling the rise of repulsive misinformation in the face of easily observed facts, that doesn't mean our computer networks are blameless. They're still doing the heavy work of locating vulnerable people and guiding them through a series of ever more extreme ideas and communities. Belief in conspiracy is a raging fire that has done real damage and poses real danger to our planet and species, from epidemics kicked off by vaccine denial to genocides kicked off by racist conspiracies to planetary meltdown caused by denial-inspired climate inaction. Our world is on fire, and so we have to put the fires out to figure out how to help people see the truth of the world through the conspiracies they've been confused by. But firefighting is reactive. We need fire prevention. We need to strike at the traumatic material conditions that make people vulnerable to the contagion of conspiracy. Here, too, tech has a role to play. There are no shortage of proposals to address this, from the EU's terrorist content regulation, which requires platforms to police and remove extremist content, to US proposals to force tech companies to spy on their users and hold them liable for their users' bad speech. There's a lot of energy to force tech companies to solve the problems they've created. There's a critical piece missing from the debate, though. All these solutions assume that tech companies are a fixture, that their dominance over the internet is a permanent fact. Proposals to replace big tech with a more diffused, pluralistic internet are nowhere to be found. Worse, the solutions on the table today require big tech to stay big, because only the very largest companies can afford to implement the systems these laws demand. Figuring out what we want our tech to look like is crucial if we're going to get out of this mess. Today, we're at a crossroads where we're trying to figure out if we want to fix the big tech companies that dominate our internet, or if we want to fix the internet itself by unshackling it from big tech's stranglehold. We can't do both, so we have to choose. I want us to choose wisely. Taming big tech is integral to fixing the internet, and for that, we need digital rights activism. Digital rights activism. A quarter century on. Digital rights activism is more than 30 years old now. The Electronic Frontier Foundation turned 30 this year. The Free Software Foundation launched in 1985. For most of the history of the movement, the most prominent criticism leveled against it was that it was irrelevant. The real activist causes were real-world causes. Think of the skepticism when Finland declared broadband a human right in 2010. And real-world activism was shoe-leather activism. Think of Malcolm Gladwell's contempt for clicktivism. But as tech has grown more central to our daily lives, these accusations of irrelevance have given way first to accusations of insincerity. You only care about tech because you're shilling for tech companies. To accusations of negligence. Why didn't you foresee that tech could be such a destructive force? But digital rights activism is right where it's always been. Looking out for the humans in a world where tech is inexorably taking over. The latest version of this critique comes in the form of surveillance capitalism, a term coined by the business professor Shoshana Zuboff in her long and influential 2019 book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism: The Fight for a Human Future at the New Frontier of Power. Zuboff argues that surveillance capitalism is a unique creature of the tech industry, and that it is unlike any other abusive commercial practice in history, one that is, quote, constituted by unexpected and often illegible mechanisms of extraction, commodification, and control that effectively exile persons from their own behavior while producing new markets of behavioral prediction and modification. Surveillance capitalism challenges democratic norms and departs in key ways from the centuries-long evolution of market capitalism. In her words, it is a new and deadly form of capitalism, a, quote, rogue capitalism, and our lack of understanding of its unique capabilities and dangers represents an existential, species-wide threat. She's right that capitalism today threatens our species, and she's right that tech poses unique challenges to our species and civilization, but she's really wrong about how tech is different and why it threatens our species. What's more, I think that her incorrect diagnosis will lead us down a path that ends up making big tech stronger, not weaker. We need to take down big tech, and to do that, we need to start by correctly identifying the problem. Tech exceptionalism, then and now. Early critics of the digital rights movement, perhaps best represented by campaigning organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Free Software Foundation, Public Knowledge, and others focused on preserving and enhancing basic human rights in the digital realm, damned activists, for practicing tech exceptionalism. Around the turn of the millennium, serious people ridiculed any claim that tech policy mattered in the, quote, real world. Claims that tech rules had implications for speech, association, privacy, search and seizure, and fundamental rights and equities were treated as ridiculous, an elevation of the concerns of sad nerds arguing about Star Trek on bulletin board systems above the struggles of the Freedom Riders, Nelson Mandela, or the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. In the decades since, accusations of tech exceptionalism have only sharpened as tech's role in everyday life has expanded. Now that tech has infiltrated every corner of our life, and our online lives have been monopolized by a handful of giants, defenders of digital freedoms are accused of carrying water for big tech, providing cover for its self-interested negligence, or worse, its nefarious plots. From my perspective, the digital rights movement has remained stationary while the rest of the world has moved. From the earliest days, the movement's concern was users and the toolsmiths who provided the code they needed to realize their fundamental rights. Digital rights activists only cared about companies to the extent that companies were acting to uphold users' rights, or just as often, when companies were acting so foolishly that they threatened to bring down new rules that would also make it harder for good actors to help users. The surveillance capitalism critique recast the digital rights movement in a new light again, not as alarmists who overestimate the importance of their shiny toys, nor as shills for big tech, but as serene deck chair rearrangers whose long-standing activism is a liability because it makes them incapable of perceiving novel threats as they continue to fight the last century's tech battles. But tech exceptionalism is a sin, no matter who practices it. All right, I think that is plenty. It was lovely to talk to you again. I'm going to go jump in the pool and do my lengths. I hope you'll check out the whole book, and I hope that you'll tune into some of the publicity coming up for Attack Surface. And I hope that if you haven't already, you'll consider pre-ordering it. That really makes an enormous difference to the fortunes of authors. Thank you very much, and I'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.